All right. Hello, everybody. Great to see your faces. For those of you who are able to turn on your cameras, it's wonderful to see familiar faces and friends and people who I've never met in person, but who I think are my friends. It's great to see all of you. It's always too long when I see your familiar faces. I think I really should teach more for Torah in Motion. I did send the source sheet. I was worried there for a bit when someone asked about the source sheet. I was worried that I forgot to do it, but Torah in Motion does have it. And of course, you can always reach out to me at msimkiewicz@ctu.edu if you have questions that we don't get to at the end of today's talk. Thank you. The link has just been put into the chat. I will speak for about 40, 45 minutes. So start thinking about your questions and your comments, which hopefully we'll have time for at the end of the hour. Of all the Jewish holidays, Hanukkah, I think, is the most difficult to understand. It's the last major holiday to be added to the Jewish calendar. And what makes it so challenging, besides the famous binary, a false binary that we construct between the idea that Jews were thinking about this as a military victory in the Second Temple period versus how the rabbis conceived of the holiday as a theological celebration of God's intervention, miraculous intervention into the destiny of the Jewish people. Hanukkah is not only difficult to understand because we have two stories, two explanations about this holiday that haven't really been synthesized. And by the way, again, that binary is incorrect. As we'll see today, Jews in the Second Temple period were absolutely retelling the story as if it was a miracle. And likewise, the rabbis do talk about the military victory. But in any case, really what makes Hanukkah so very difficult is the fact that it happened to just a tiny percentage of the Jews who were around in the early second century BCE, in 175 to 167 BCE. By this time, the vast majority of Jews are not in the immediate vicinity of Jerusalem. Probably the majority of Jews are even living outside of Judea. I've talked about this many times. If you've taken a Torah in Motion class with me, you know the spiel. There could have been up to 1 million Jews living in Egypt by the first century CE, but a conservative estimate would have been a couple hundred thousand. Alexandria was a hub. It was the New York City of the ancient world. It was cosmopolitan. There were Jews there. Whatever you learned about Hanukkah in your yeshiva day school, if you went to one, is wrong. There is no linguistic or geographic binary between where a Jew lived and what language they spoke and how they practiced their Judaism. That binary did not exist. And so you have pious, law-observant Jews all over the Hellenistic world. And these Jews were not immediately impacted by the shocking victory of the Hasmonean militia over the Seleucid Greeks, again, in 175 to 167 BCE. So the story affects just a tiny population. If let's say you have 600,000-700,000 Jews in Judea and, 60, 70,000 Jews that are in Jerusalem, again, these are really, really hard to estimate. But again, if you're a Jew, you're living in Antioch in modern day Syria, or you're living in Cyprus, you're living in North Africa in Cyrene, you're living in Alexandria, wherever you are, the question really becomes, once you hear about this story, does this story have anything to do with me? Is this a story about the Jewish people? Or is this a story about what happened, very significantly, what happened to my Judean kin? And so right away, forget the binary between the military victory and the miraculous victory. Let's put that aside momentarily. The question is this an event that says something about God's relationship with all Jewish people? And if so, does that obligate all Jewish people to recognize and commemorate this story for perpetuity with a holiday? And so this question is not clear. And we know that the question is not clear because we have debates about it that are preserved. And what we're going to do in the next 40 minutes or so is take a deeper look into some ancient texts that suggest that Jews, depending on where they lived, even though, again, there isn't a geographic binary between where you live and how you practice, but there is a difference between how Judeans, again, in Judea, interpreted the story and how Jews received the story on the other end in the diaspora. And I want to look at some Judean letters that were dispatched to Jews living in Egypt in the late 2nd century BCE. And these letters make an active case that the Jews of the diaspora are obligated to observe the holiday of Hanukkah. No one says Hanukkah. That word doesn't exist until the rabbinic period. You'll see in some texts it's called the Day of Purification, and others the Festival of Tabernacles, of Sukkot. But these Judean letters to Egyptian Jews argue that this is a story that's not only relevant to all diasporan Jews, but in fact is a story that is more about diasporan Jewry than the Judeans who actually witnessed it. How we get to this logical somersault is going to be very interesting. But you probably know that there are actually four books of Maccabees. They're preserved in Christian canonical lists, in the famous Apocrypha, which is part of the Catholic canon. We have two books of Maccabees, one Maccabees, two Maccabees. They're very, very different books. One Maccabees is produced in Hebrew, in Judea, by someone who worked within the Hasmonean court and wanted to elevate the Hasmonean family and legitimize them. Two Maccabees is very, very different. It's written in Greek. It's diasporan. It's written by someone who had no eyewitness exposure to the story. And this book, Two Maccabees, which is one of my favorite books produced in the Second Temple period. I wish we could be talking about Two Maccabees. Sometime about a half a century after Two Maccabees was written, maybe a little more, an editor, a Jewish scribe who was copying the book in the first century BCE, copying it onto another, whatever it was, a scroll, papyrus, we're not sure, is copying it onto another document. And he adds two letters to this book of Two Maccabees. And these letters seem to be real, true historical letters that were, again, dispatched by Judean leaders in the vicinity of Jerusalem to Jews living in Egypt. And this editor thought that these letters were so significant and so connected to the story that is told in Two Maccabees that he uses them as an introduction to his book. So you can go onto any website that has the Bible with the Apocrypha. You can go onto what I usually use is bible.oremus.org, just because it has an easy search engine. So if you go to bible.oremus.org and you put in Two Maccabees, chapter one, you are not going to see the beginning of the historical Two Maccabees. You're going to see these letters all the way up until chapter two, verse 18. If you have questions or comments, I would ask that you save them till the latter half of the class, just because it keeps popping up. But I'm not going to be reading comments unless it's a comment of that requires clarification, or I didn't translate something, or I'm going too fast, in which case maybe you could use the hand raise feature so that I'll see it, because I do talk fast and I'm really working on myself to slow down 98% of the time. It's totally unsuccessful. So if there's a clarification question, use the hand raise feature, but otherwise let's use the chat towards the second half of the class. All right, so this editor in the first century BCE has access to these letters, and he says, I'm going to start this work of Two Maccabees.
Have you ever seen the sun set here on Sundays?
I don't get sunsets.
Would you like to have it on Sundays?
Okay, we are. Okay, I'm going to mute. Everyone should be muted automatically, but who knows how to use Zoom? All right. So what are we going to say about the Jews of Egypt more specifically? This is probably the most active hub outside the land of Israel in the second century BCE. Many of us might be familiar with the injunction preserved in Devarim in Deuteronomy that the Jews cannot return to Mitzrayim, to Egypt. And in fact, if you look at how Egypt is allegorized and sort of set up as a prototype in Tanakh, you'll see it's very, very obvious that it's presented as the opposite of the land of Israel, right? Just in the sense of the self-irrigating Nile, that the people don't have to connect to a god. Of course, they worship the Nile itself. They worship the Pharaoh, but this is symbolically opposite of the land of Israel, which requires a connection with God and prayer for rain in order to provide fertility in the land. There are all kinds of ways that these two regions are presented by the in the Tanakh as opposite. And yet the reality is that Jews are living there. And not only are these Jews living there, but they're pious Jews. They're observing Shabbat and circumcision and dietary law, and they're reading their scriptures, and they're gathering in synagogues, and they're interpreting their scriptures, and they view themselves as very pious. And that is a very important key to understand. These Jews are not apologizing for being in the diaspora. They did not make a connection between their particular circumstances and the gola, the biblical notion of exile. They rejected the idea that life outside the land of Israel was symbolic of divine rejection. And at the end of the day, these Jews did very, very well. So without assimilating, they're still rising in the social, economic, and political ranks of Egyptian life. And so we have a lot of interesting details. For example, Josephus preserves many of these details that describe the ways in which Jews are participating in very high levels of government. Cleopatra II at the end of the second century BCE has two high-ranking Jewish generals who are advising her. Their father is Onias, the famous Judean priest who flees from Judea because Hellenizers are trying to kill him. So again, this binary between where you live and how you practice your Judaism, it's really problematic. And I always say this around the time of Hanukkah, because we often are exposed to this idea of, you know, if you were the land of Israel, you were authentic, you had an uncorrupted form of Judaism. But if you lived outside of the land of Israel, you were assimilated or on the way to being assimilated. In any case, so these letters. These letters were dispatched, like I said, to Egyptian communities. And they must have been considered of value because they were preserved, they were circulated. But I think we should take a deep dive into these letters with the remaining half hour that we have and see if we can learn anything about how Judeans not only made a case to the diasporan kin that the story of Hanukkah was relevant to them, but also made a case for Judean exceptionalism. So Hanukkah becomes a template, not only to say God takes an interest in the Jewish people and also intervenes in miraculous ways, but to make a case about Judean exceptionalism to diasporan Jews who the Judean writers think should be moving to the land of Israel. If you want to make contemporary parallels in your own lives, you're perfectly welcome to do that, but I won't. I'll just be insinuating that. Okay, so we're going to go to the source sheet. Let's see if I have the right one up. Is this, these are my notes. I always do that. Hold on one second. Let's see. Is this the right one? Okay, so now you should see a timeline. You see a timeline? All right, so we're just going to scroll down the timeline. Hold on one second. Now I have
that a little bigger, please.
Yeah, sure. First, I have to work on getting my face out of the way. So that's project number one. Okay. Sorry. Hold on a second. Oh, my word. Okay. So now I'm going to make this a little bigger. How's that?
Thank you.
Okay. You can also use the link for the source sheet if you want to play around or look at text that I don't have right in front of me. Okay. So we begin. The first 10 verses of the book of 2 Maccabees is actually not the book of 2 Maccabees. Again, it is a letter. What's fantastic about this letter is that unlike the vast majority of ancient documents that we have, it is dated. It's dated to the year 188. Does that mean 188 BCE? No, of course not. By the way, there was no year zero. Zero doesn't exist. And also they can't be counting down to anything. So what's 188? Does anybody know?
King, Your Honor?
Sorry?
Date to some king?
Yeah, exactly. Very, very good. So they're counting down from the beginning of the Seleucid Empire, which is founded.
Are they counting from the Canopus decree of -3/112?
Yes, very good. Excellent. I don't know who said that, but that is correct. Yes.
I said that.
Okay. Excellent. Right. Okay. So so this would be around 143 BCE. But that's, I just skipped to the end. Let's start with the beginning. Okay. To our brothers, the Jews of Egypt, greeting. Now, already we have a lot of hints here. A typical Hellenistic letter would open up by naming the speaker and then the addressee. But Semitic letters produced in Aramaic or in Hebrew, and you'll find these also preserved in Tanakh, begin with the addressee and then identify the letter writing. So what does it tell you that we have a Greek text, right? It's preserved in Greek, but that begins in a Semitic style to our brothers, the Jews of Egypt, greeting your brothers, the Jews in Jerusalem in the land of Judah. This tells us that there's a very strong likelihood, this is what we call Semiticism, there's a very strong likelihood that this text was written originally in Aramaic. maybe even Hebrew, but there are some Semiticisms in this Greek document that suggest an original that was not written in Greek. Very important, all right? Because when you are writing in your own lingua franca, you are setting the terms for the discourse. And so they're writing to their Greek-speaking Jews, but they're using their own language. That's what it seems. All right, a good piece. Again, that is a phrase that would have made a lot of sense in Hebrew. Shalom Tov. We don't know that there was like a typical phrase in Greek that would have been equivalent to that. May God make for you, and may he be good to you, and may he remember his covenant with his faithful servants, Abraham, Isaac, Abraham, Yisrael, and Yaakov. Okay, reference to the patriarchs. We have very nice bracha here. Now I'm going to interpret this opening bracha, and when I've done this in the past, many people disagree with me, so feel free to disagree with me, but save your articulation of your disagreement for the end. When they say, may he give you all a heart to revere him and to do his will wholeheartedly with a willing spirit, and may he open your heart to his Torah and to his commandments. This is a very disproportionately long opening bracha, right? I mean, this is half the letter, right? So this is the letter, and more than half of the letter is an opening bracha. This is disproportionate to the standard letter writing styles of the time. Usually, if you have a letter, let's say it's 10 lines, the first one or two lines will be a bracha. Here, over half of the letter is the introductory bracha. That's unusual. That's disproportionate. And the nature of the bracha, to me, suggests that they are dissatisfied with their Judean kin. Why do I see that? Again, I've had plenty of people read this with me and they say, I don't see that at all. So fine. But what I see is when someone says, may God give you a heart to revere God, may God open your heart to his Torah, what I hear is a subtext that the hearts of the Egyptian Jews are closed, or at least not open in the way that they should be. Now, is this the reality on the ground? No, this is the perception of the Judeans who are writing to their kin. May God help you to access what he's already made available to you, right? The Torah, the commandments. May God, and this is very telling, listen to your prayers and forgive you and not abandon you in an evil time. Now, what evil time would that have been? Well, in the second century BCE, the Jews are caught in civil war in Egypt. There are all kinds of conflicts, particularly again between Cleopatra II and her brother Physcon. They are fighting over control over the Ptolemaic Greek Empire, and the Jews have to choose a side. Repeatedly, they choose the wrong side. It's not the only time that the Jews of Egypt choose the losing side. They support Cleopatra. She ends up not being successful. That puts the Jews at an incredible risk, incredible vulnerability, because they are not part of the majority population that is supporting her brother. Hold on one second. I see something else in the chat. Yeah. So let's, if we could just put it, it is passive aggressive 100%. But we'll save things for a little bit later, because I want to make sure I can get this all done. We have about 25 minutes left. Okay. So it's absolutely passive aggressive. Whoever said that is correct. And yeah, again, the bracha, may God open your heart, may God listen to your prayers and forgive you, again, suggests that the Jews have taken some sort of responsibility, or that they bear some sort of responsibility for the situation that they find themselves in. And then, but don't worry, Jews of Egypt, we offer prayers for you. You are in our hearts. So we got you covered spiritually. We're praying to God, and we only hope that you can open your heart to God's law. By the way, my book that is not out yet on the diaspora is tentatively called Open Your Heart to His Law, but I don't know if the editors will accept that, because usually they like the title to be something more specific to the content of the book. We'll see. But it's one of my favorite phrases, Open Your Heart to His Law. Here, nomos is the Greek. Nomos could be Torah. Nomos could be law. Torah is actually the better translation. And here, this is not, by the way, the NRSV standard translation. This is a superior translation by the outstanding scholar, Jonathan Goldstein. You cannot find this online, but it's from the Anchor Bible Commentary, and I highly recommend it if you're interested in really, really good scholarship on these texts. Okay, so here's the letter. It's like a teeny tiny letter. And what's interesting about this letter is that it embeds a little letter inside of it. Okay, so in the reign of Demetrius, in the year 169, we Jews wrote to you. So 169, again, that's 143 BCE. So they're writing 188, which is 124. Right? Let me see what I said. I'm bad at math. Yeah, it's 124, but they're referencing 143. So about 20 years ago, we wrote a letter to you, and they cite the letter. We Judeans wrote a letter to you. We wrote the following. We're having some trouble. in 143 BCE, and this is residual from the Hasmonean conflict. The Hasmonean conflict does not end in 167. Things keep going along, not so smoothly. If you read the end of 1 Maccabees and 2 Maccabees, you can know more about that. But we wrote you in our times of distress 20 years ago. What do we say? In the affliction and in the distress, which came upon us in the years from the time that Jason, that the Hellenizer Jew, Jason and his followers reveled against the Holy Land and the kingdom. By the way, note that the enemies in these texts are always other Jews, not really the Greeks. Right? Judah Maccabee is, yeah, he's fighting the Seleucid Greeks, but really he's fighting his fellow Jews. And we have this crazy detail in 1 Maccabees about Judah plumaging, is that even a word? Plum something, the countryside, and forcibly circumcising Hellenized Jews. 1 Maccabees tells us that he did that. He forcibly circumcised. We're not talking about babies. We're talking about adult Jews. Can you imagine the violence that goes into that? So yeah, we wrote to you about the time that Jason, the Hellenized Jew, and his followers reveled against the Holy Land and the kingdom. They set fire to the temple gateway. They shed innocent blood, or it's an intra-Jewish conflict. We prayed to God and he heartened to us. We brought sacrifices. We kindled the lamps. We laid out the showbread. In other words, we restored the violated temple, which he, by the way, again, blames the Jews for, not the Greeks. And now we're good, right? We've established the Hasmonean monarchy in 124 BC. Things are a lot calmer. They're making alliances with Rome, which is a nascent political player in the late second century BC. It's not the fearsome empire we know from two centuries later, but Rome is showing up. And so things are a little more stable. We're good. God isn't angry at us anymore. The right Jews are in control. We see that you're having a little bit of issues, though. And it's come to our attention, you might not be commemorating what happened to us, right? Turns out, you know, we thought that you would be recognizing the huge event that took place in Judea. Guess you're not. We're asking you. And so if this 124 is 40 years after the initial miracle, the initial restoration of the temple, the Beit HaMikdash, we ask you to celebrate what? The Days of Tabernacles in the month of Kislev. Such a little delicious detail, the Days of Tabernacles, right? Hanukkah, again, not a word shows up in Second Temple literature, but the Days of Tabernacles, I'm not going to go into all the ways that Zechariah might or might not allude to a holiday that preceded the war in 175. We know those sources, and I think that there are other outstanding Torah Moshe lectures in the past that have addressed Zechariah and post-exilic Jewish literature. But what's interesting again is that there is no the pshat here, I would just say, is that there was no ability in the year that they were restoring the temple, the Beit HaMikdash, there was no ability for them to celebrate Sukkot at the right time. So the pshat is that they had to push off Sukkot to the end of December, to Kislev. And so the first time when they're restoring the temple on Chaf Hei Kislev, they are saying, okay, this celebration is also going to be a celebration of the holiday that we were unable to most recently celebrate in that Sukkot. Again, so they're calling it the Days of Tabernacles. Now we'll see in the second letter that they actually have a different name for the holiday, which suggests that there is some debate about what precisely the nature of this holiday is. Okay, so we're going to try again to maybe keep comments off the chat, and I really appreciate that. I know everyone has different policies about it, but so it's 11:26 in Chicago. So in about 15 minutes, if you want to start putting things in the chat, that'd be fantastic. We have one more letter to do. Okay, so what does this letter suggest? This letter suggests that there is a misalignment between how Jews in Judea are understanding what happened, right, what we'll call Hanukkah, and how they perceive their diasporan kin to be understanding Hanukkah, which is to say, incorrectly. There is a perception that Jews in Egypt are not properly recognizing that this is a holiday that has pertinence to all Jews. And now we'll see that there's another letter, and this letter was written by different Jews that expresses the same thing, but makes a very detailed argument that not only is Hanukkah relevant to diasporan Jews, but actually the story of Hanukkah is about diasporan Jews. And what I love about this text, among many things, is that it contains the oldest reference to a miracle that has to do with fire. And so next time someone says to you, oh, well, the miracle of oil was made up by a 6th century Talmudic document preserved in the Talmud, you know, my Hanukkah, that's the first time we see any reference to a miracle. No, we're going to see that this very ancient text argues for a miracle connected to fire. And so there was at a very early stage stories about this. I think I forgot to include Josephus in the source sheet, but I do want to just skip ahead to the late first century CE historian Josephus, who says, when he's talking about this historic period, and he talks about the victory of the Hasmoneans over the Seleucid Greeks, and he says, and by the way, today we all Jews, and he's writing from Rome, all of us Jews celebrate this holiday. We call it lights. And does anyone know offhand the explanation that Josephus offers for calling the holiday lights in the 90s CE? Anyone know? You just unmute yourselves. According to Josephus, why is Hanukkah called the holiday of lights again in around 95 CE? Well, Josephus says, I have no idea. I have a tradition that we call this holiday lights, and I don't know why. And then he offers some sort of like very weak allegorical explanation, saying, well, it must be we were in a period of psychological and religious darkness, and then God brought light back into our lives, which literally you could do with any single holiday. It was bad, then it was good, lights. So Josephus doesn't know. And he says, actually, he's not sure, he doesn't know. But that is valuable information, because it tells us that by the end of the first century CE, there's an ancient, ancient tradition associating Hanukkah with lights. The reason for this association has been lost. But if it's been lost, that tells us you're dealing with a very ancient tradition. So even when an ancient writer says, here's something that we do and I don't know why, even that is valuable information. Now that brings us to our letter. Our letter, which is dated to the end of the 2nd century BCE, although scholars do debate, was this letter written as a literary text? In other words, never dispatched to Egyptian Jews, but sort of framed as a letter, copying the format of this authentic letter, which we're almost certain really was dispatched. This has more of a literary flair. So scholars debate, was this actually sent or was it written as a letter, but not sent? Okay. Doesn't matter for my purposes, because either way, this is a Judean text that tells us how the writer wants diaspora and Jews to act. And that's what we're interested in right now. All right, the people in Jerusalem and in Judea and the council of elders and Judas to Aristobulus, the tutor of the king and member of the stock of the anointed priests. Again, we have the writers first and the addressees second. Here we have the addressees first and the writer second. So that's a difference. And it could point to a Greek original. These things are speculative. All right. So we, the people in Jerusalem, the council of elders, and Judas. So could that be Judah Maccabee who's writing this letter? It's very possible. There are three options. Either it's a different Judah, or the writer wants you to read this as a letter written by Judah Maccabee, or it really was written by Judah Maccabee. We don't know. But it does seem to be not a coincidence that the main writer here is Yehuda. And who does he write to? Aristobulus, who is a high-ranking Jew in Egypt, tutor of King Ptolemy. But this is a very important detail that we can easily skip over. A member of the stock of the anointed priests. So he's identifying the recipient, the Jewish recipient in Egypt, as being a Kohen, as being connected to the temple. And the implication here is you, Aristobulus, have a personal stake in this story. And we're going to see that in the body of the letter, there's an implication that the priests take on a leadership role when it comes to gathering the exiled Judeans back to the land. And so there's an implication, you, Aristobulus, you're not doing what you should be doing. You should be in Jerusalem administrating the temple. You're not, but let me tell you a story about some other priests, namely Jeremiah, Jeremiahu, and some others who actually did their job. So I'm sort of giving away the end. That's okay. All right, so Aristobulus, we're identifying you by your high political rank, your tutor of King Ptolemy. You are a member of the priesthood, and we're also addressing all the Jews in Egypt. Greetings and wishes for good health. This is much more typical of a standard Greek letter, which doesn't go on and on and on with a bracha, but just, we hope you're well. It's like, dear Dr. Simkovich, I hope you're well. Please send me 800 source sheets. You know, straight into the point. Having been saved by God from great perils, we thank him greatly as befits men who war against the king, for God himself cast away those who made war on the holy city. And so this is an introductory line, a kind of title page. Here we're going to tell you the story of God saving us from great perils. And then we have a paragraph that I'm not going to spend a lot of time on, but this paragraph seems to be a fictional account, or at least an inaccurate account, of the death of Antiochus, Antiochus IV Epiphanes. So, by the way, things are pretty good for us. We don't know if you heard, but Antiochus IV Epiphanes had a horrible death after he attacked Judea that befit his bad behavior. And so we have like a little aside in this paragraph. When I highlight, do you see the highlighting? See the highlighting? Okay, thank you for nodding. So yeah, Antiochus fell through a trap door when he was worshiping an idolatrous god, and died a terrible death. So yay, in every way, blessed is our God who delivered over the evil. So it's sort of like a PS, a postscript to the story, even though we don't have the actual story yet. Anyway, so did you hear that Antiochus died a death that was mida k'neged mida, that was appropriate to his terrible character? Inasmuch as we're about to celebrate on the 25th of Kislev, the purification of the temple. Now, this could be a description of the holiday or a name for the holiday. It's probably a name for the holiday. We thought we ought to let you know so that you too might celebrate it, as in when Nehemiah. What's going on with Nehemiah? Why is Nehemiah here? The builder of the temple and the altar brought sacrifices. Okay. A few things. What the authors are going to do is they're going to push the story of God's intervention into the destiny of the Jerusalemite administrators of the temple, back into the early history of the Jews, so that the significance of the theme that God intervenes on behalf of the temple and those who worship at it well precedes the story of Hanukkah. And again, there's an implication that by this late stage, late second century BCE, the Jews in Egypt are not celebrating Hanukkah. Or at least that's what the writers think. They're getting wind of the fact that maybe Jews in Egypt are saying, listen, that's great, awesome, thumbs up that God did that for you. It's not particular or relevant to us. It's not a national holiday, right? So there are some holidays that are limited to a particular subpopulation. Great job. Enjoy it. Not for us. And so they say, we're going to tell you a story that argues that this is about all Jews, and that really Hanukkah symbolically goes well, it begins well before 175 BCE. And so here's the story, and the story begins with Nehemiah. When our forefathers, how are we doing for time? Terrible. Okay, I'll go a little faster. When our forefathers were being carried off to Persia, the pious priest, and again, he's talking to Aristobulus, who's a Jewish priest living in Egypt, not doing his job. And there were Jewish temples in Egypt, by the way, at this time. The pious priest, so we're talking in the very beginning of the 6th century BCE with the Babylonian exile, right? 587, somewhere between 597, 586. The Judean priests are going from Judea to exile. What do? The pious priest of that time secretly takes some fire from the altar. They hide it in a pit. They shut it up securely, right? They take fire from the Beit HaMikdash and they hide it. Many years go by and the exile comes to an end. Nehemiah, the great Nehemiah, who shepherds the Judeans back to the land of Israel. And he does so in collaboration again with priests. Very important that the leaders are always priests. Nehemiah says, I heard about this fire that was hidden by the priests who were going into exile. He tells his priests, go find that fire. They go to the cave, right? They're back in Judea. They've returned from exile. They're looking in cave after cave after cave. They're in the Judean wilderness. We don't see a fire. What do they find? They go into a cave and they just find this like weird, gloopy, viscous liquid. Imagine like tar on a hot day. That's how I imagine it. Some viscous, liquidy stuff. Nehemiah's like, well, maybe this is the fire. What are we going to do? Well, they decide to put it on an altar, right? They bring some sacrifices. And then, does someone have a question? I hear someone jumping in. Okay, so maybe just mute. So Nehemiah says to the priest, let's see what happens if we put the liquid on the altar. And what happens? A great big miracle happened there. And that had been done. Okay, this is a miracle. It's after a while, it's lying in the sun. It's been covered by clouds. But then what happens? The sun begins to shine. And a great, I don't know what a shire is. Is that a typo? I have to look it up. Blazes up to the astonishment of all. They can't believe it. This is a miracle. This must be a sign that God finds favor with this community of exiled returnees. God is happy that they've returned. And this is a sign that God wants them to rebuild the second temple. Everything is great. They have found favor with God. This diasporan community did the right thing. They returned to the site of the destroyed Beit HaMikdash. This miracle happens. They've now decided, okay, this is a sign from God to rebuild the Beit HaMikdash. And this is a miracle of fire. Okay, it's not anything to do with 175 BC, but it's a miracle. So the Nehemiah says, oh my gosh, this is unbelievable what just happened, a miraculous ignition. And he has Yonatan, the high priest, deliver this incredible prayer. Yonatan leads the people in prayer. Now, just scan this. We're a little bit pressed for time, but just scan the prayer. The prayer seems very strange. Usually when we see liturgy, we're just like, skip, scroll down, side swipe or whatever. But not all prayers are created equal. And this is a strange prayer, right? God, wow, thank you so much. The preserver of Israel from every exile, the one who chose and sanctified the patriarchs. Accept our sacrifice for the sake of all your people, Israel, and God, guard your portion and make it holy. Gather together our dispersion. Free those who are enslaved among the nations. What in the world is this request doing in a Thanksgiving prayer? God has just given them a sign to rebuild the Beit HaMikdash. The people have returned. Everything is great. Just say thank you and shut up about it. Why are they saying, gather together our dispersion, free those enslaved among the nations? Now you need to use some reader response theory. Think about how this would have been received by Aristobulus, the Egyptian Jew, who's reading this text, right, with his Egyptian Jewish compatriots. Maybe they're also from priestly communities. And what are they reading? They're reading a Judean text that tells them that diasporan Jews were wishing, above all, that God bring everyone home. And so the Judean writers of this text are hoping that the message will be received by their, again, late second century BCE Egyptian Jewish kin, that the message is, even in 538 or 515 or whatever, 520 BCE, Judeans were coming back at their own peril, at their own risk, coming back from exile to Judea and begging God to open the hearts of the Egyptian Jews, the diasporan Jews, the exile Jews, and galvanize their return. That's what this letter is about. Anyway, so what happens, after they bring more sacrifices, another flame blazes up, and this portion of the letter seems to be missing some material. But whatever the case is, whatever happens with another miraculous blaze, the news of the phenomenon spreads. People are like, wow, this is a big miracle. We can't believe it. We're so very excited. Even the Persian king says, oh, I heard that there was a miracle that took place at the site of the destroyed temple that signified to the Judeans that they should rebuild the second temple. And he sort of cordons it off and turns it into a sacred landmark. He verifies the phenomenon. And the king has the place fenced in and declared holy. Just like today, when you have to make a landmark, you need to verify that something actually happened there. The king takes large amounts of money and he gives them to Nehemiah. Great. And they call the liquid Neftar. There's all kinds of scholarly etymological studies about what that word means, but here the letter says it means purification. Okay. All right. So I'm going to have to stretch this out to another 10 minutes, but we can do this fast. The next section of the letter pushes the connection between diasporan Jewry and the restoration of the temple back into an earlier stage of history, right? He told us a miracle happened in the time of Nehemiah at the end of the second, 6th century BCE. Now he tells us that something, in fact, happened even earlier in the time of Yirmiyahu in the early 6th century BC. What happened? And Yirmiyahu is yet another priest. In our documents, we find that who was the priest or the prophet who hid the fire that Nehemiah looked for? Well, it was none other than Yirmiyahu himself. And so what did Yirmiyahu do? And we have text to prove it. This letter says our texts show that the prophet Yirmiyahu gave the Torah to those who were being led into exile. He admonished them to not forget the Lord's commandments. And again, the implication is to these Egyptian Jews, you are forgetting the Lord's commandments. So the intended audience here is not the Judeans of Yirmiyahu's own time, but the Egyptian Jews of the late second century. Yirmiyahu told the Jews in exile to not let their minds be astray when they saw gold and silver images. Maybe you should take Yirmiyahu's words to heart. So there are all these layers. There's the citation of Yirmiyahu speaking to the exiled Jews, but then there's the framing of this text as a Judean letter to the Egyptian Jews of the Hellenistic period. Okay, so Yirmiyahu hid the fire. And when people tried to mark the path, he said, no, the place must remain unknown until God gathers his people together in the age of mercy. And then the letter seeks to push the connection between the diaspora community and the Temple Mount even farther into early history, again through an image of fire. And this time he refers to Shlomo and then to Moshe. Now, this section of the letter, again, is quite corrupt. There seems to be missing lines. So it might not make sense if you just read it straight through. The point that I want to make is that you have Nehemiah, and then earlier you have Yirmiyahu, and then earlier you have Shlomo, and then earlier you have Moshe, who are all getting signs from God through miraculous fiery ignitions that tell them that God desires all people to be in the vicinity of the Temple Mount and Jerusalem. That message is supposed to be resonant to Jews living in Egypt in the late second century BCE, who have not only selected to not return to the land of Israel, but apparently are also not celebrating the purification holiday. So we write to you, please, please celebrate the purification. Please celebrate the days. God who saved his entire people and restored the heritage to us all. God, we hope, will speedily have mercy upon us and gather us together from, that's a typo, the lands under the heavens, his holy place, for he has indeed delivered us from great evils. So the emphasis here is that the stories in which God miraculously showed himself to the people is not relevant to only the immediate witnesses of these miracles, but immediate to all Jews. Why? Because they teach us that God cares about every single Jew. God cares about all the people. And we have to continue to hope that God will restore all people. And there's no evidence that diasporan Jews bought into this. We have not a single diasporan text, besides maybe 2 Maccabees itself, but that's arguable. We have not a single diasporan text, in my opinion, that explicitly asks God to put an end to the diaspora. We have a lot of Judean texts that include liturgical material that ask God to put a permanent end to the diaspora. But we have no evidence that this idea was reciprocated or mimicked in the diaspora itself. Now, these Jews in diaspora, they're pious, they're observant, they have a connection to the land of Israel, but they are not praying these prayers. And as much as the writers want Aristobulus and his buddies to read and therefore repeat and affirm and reiterate these prayers, right? As they're reading it, they're affirming it. God, will you please restore the exile to the land of Israel? I have a lot of doubt that this resonated with the Egyptian Jewish community. Now, I don't think that these letters are the only ones that are significant when we're talking about Judean efforts to convince Egyptian Jews that they needed to affirm Judean exceptionalism, that they needed to relate to the destiny of Judean Jews as if it was immediately connected to them. We also have a very interesting closing section of the Greek version of Esther, which suggests that other Judeans too were really focused on the community of Jews in Egypt and really wanted these Egyptian Jews to affirm Judean exceptionalism and ideally to return to Judea. We often think of the Greek version of Esther, if we think about it at all, as being representative of a Hellenistic kind of a thinking. It uses a lot of Hellenistic stylistic features. It has speeches, it has pathos, it has soliloquies, it has drama, it has all kinds of like sensual imagery that we don't find in Hebrew Esther. But it was produced in Jerusalem. And the Greek translation of Esther, which has all these changes from the Hebrew version, is a Judean document. It's written in Greek, but it's a Judean document. It probably includes Hellenistic flourishes because it wanted to appeal specifically to Jews living in Hellenistic diasporan lands. But the message of the story might not be a message that Judean writers believed legitimized the diaspora. And of course, we know that by the rabbinic period, the rabbis are producing midrashim that read Esther's story as a critique of the diaspora. It seems that that was happening very early on. The closing signature of the Greek version of Esther reads as follows. In the fourth year of the reign of Ptolemy and Cleopatra, there are a few Ptolemy and Cleopatra, brother, sister, husband, wife, queen, king, partners. This is probably 76 BCE. In the reign of Ptolemy and Cleopatra, Dositheus, that's another typo. I don't think that had should be there, who said that he was a priest and a Levite, and his son Ptolemy, that's a Jew, brought to Egypt the foregoing letter about Purim, which they said was authentic and translated by Lysimachus, one of the residents of Jerusalem. Who cares? Why do we need this? It's very rare for an authoritative ancient Jewish document to have a colophon that talks about the writers and who they were. Who cares? Why is this detail so important? Because Dositheus, who is writing the Greek version of Esther, is identifying himself as a priest and a Levite and grounding the authority of the story in his Jerusalem identity, reversing the current of influence from the diaspora, which is where the book is written according to the end of Esther, right? Mordechai and Esther write the book, disseminate the book. And this colophon, these little words, reverse the current of influence from being a diasporan work that moves to the land of Israel into being a Judean work that moves into the Judean community in Egypt. In other words, the implication here is that the authority of Esther and the authority of the holiday of Purim only works because it's grounded in the writer's connection to the Jerusalem temple. The writer was a priest and a Levite, Lysimachus, a resident of Jerusalem. Actually, Dositheus is the dispatcher, who's the priest and Levite, and the translator is a resident of Jerusalem, but they're both probably residents of Jerusalem. Why is this significant? What does it have to do with the two letters appended to Maccabees? I think that the colophon, the ending signature of Greek Esther, suggests that there's a real concern among Judean leaders in the second century, first century BCE, that Jews in the diaspora are not properly recognizing the centrality and exceptionalism of Judea and the temple. Some Egyptian Jews, it appears, are not celebrating Hanukkah, and those diasporan Jews who are celebrating Purim might be celebrating in ways that valorize or legitimize the diaspora. And for Judeans, that's unacceptable. Yes, let's celebrate Hanukkah. Let's celebrate Purim. And let's read the book of Esther. But don't for a second think that the story of Esther is a story about legitimizing the diaspora. That's not what it's about. And the colophon tells us the authority of Esther rests in Jerusalem. From this flowers an entire body of rabbinic tradition that Esther is actually a critique of the diaspora. I don't know that that's in the shot. All right, what we're going to do now is... I can't, unfortunately, read all of these questions and comments. Of course, the winter solstice, I could talk about that, but why don't we invite participants now to raise their hand with questions and comments. Is that possible, Shira? Can people use the hand feature? So you click on reactions and then you will see a raise hand feature. So why don't we try that? And then if people don't want to do that, then I'll read the chat. Okay, so I see iPad is raising his hand. Or her hand.
It's his hand. Do you have any parallels between how quickly the Hanukkah and Purim were accepted both within Israel and diaspora to Yom HaAtzma'ut and Yom HaShoah today? I have to start with the political question because I'm political.
Oh, but I'm not political. I mean, I am, but not in my teaching.
But in terms of the time periods and the efforts, et cetera, et cetera.
I mean, look, I will say this. I think that there's an extraordinary misalignment between how Israeli Jews perceive diaspora Jewry and their identity and how diaspora Jews perceive themselves. And I think that that parallel is very hard to miss. And I'll just say a little more. You know, I don't think that diasporan Jews tend to self-reference as diasporan Jews. I don't say, hi, I'm Malka Simkovich and I'm a diasporan Jew. But the Israeli government has a ministry to the diaspora. And it's a word that means a lot and that serves an Israeli self-understanding. Yom Ha'atzmaut, I do see parallels. The question again is, you know, does this pertain to us? The consensus, though, that I see in the Orthodox diasporan community is that, yes, it does. I mean, unless you're in the right-wing Haredi world, you are going to see consensus that it was meaningful for all the Jewish people. But the questions are the same. Of course, yes.
All right. And you know that the Babylonian Jewry viewed themselves as at least equal, the rabbinate there, to Eretz Yisrael. So they had no problems of inferiority. They actually felt themselves in many ways to be superior to the authority in Israel.
I would put it a little differently. There's a lot of interesting scholarship on this, but I do think that there are also sources that express ambivalence from that can be traced to Babylonian traditions, ambivalence, but also a desire to legitimize that rabbinic community in Babylonia. But there's a lot of interesting scholarship on this. You can make an argument that, no, I don't think you can argue that they say, oh, we're inferior and we have, you know, nothing compared to you. But definitely there are a few sources that also acknowledge the superiority of the rabbis and Levites. So it's complicated. And what I wouldn't want to do is try to harmonize and synthesize all those rabbinic traditions, but there's a lot of interesting scholarship on it. All right, Asher Stein, please.
The first letter you pointed out that it was written in Greek and reliably translated. The second letter was also written in Greek?
No, I think the first letter is a Semitic text. I would have to go back to Goldstein and double check, but
why did he translate it from? We only have it in Greek.
There is no surviving Semitic text today. He's using a Greek text and he's translating it. Goldstein was a great scholar and his Greek was outstanding.
Okay.
Based on Semiticisms that he finds in the first letter, I believe he says that he thinks that this was originally written in Aramaic.
The second letter is who translated that? That's also being translated from Greek, and we don't know whether it originally was written in Greek or Aramaic or Hebrew.
Correct.
But who translated it? Is it as reliable a translation? Because some of the phraseology may actually be different than the way it's been translated.
You're talking about translation into Greek or translation into English?
No, I'm talking about the translation into English from Greek. The source that we have is Greek, even though we don't know whether the original source was Greek or a Semitic language. But the translation that you presented to us, is that who translated that? How reliable is it?
Goldstein's translation is the best. It is superior to NRSV, which you can find online for free. And there are many other free translations of the Apocrypha that you can get online that are inferior to Goldstein. Right now, what's out there, I would put Goldstein at the top.
And the second letter is also from Goldstein.
And you can buy the Anchor Bible and read his very extensive commentary because he goes into linguistic detail defending his translation and engaging with other translations and explaining where he diverges. It's very, very good. It's old. I think that it was written in 79 or something, but it's not yet outdated. It hasn't been replaced. All right. Other questions or should I go to the chat? I'm not gonna talk about the winter solstice, but we have some information. The viscous inflammable material that was found by Nehemiah foreshadows Hanukkah. No, but that's exactly my point, right? Is that we have a story about miraculous igniting of fire that the writers argue precedes the story of Hanukkah. And by doing that, he says to the Jews in Egypt, you have a shared history here because our ancestors experienced this together. And so if the story started in 175, then it wouldn't be relevant to the Jews in Egypt. But by pushing the story back into the 6th century BC and even earlier, he's saying, you and I, we have a shared history that's equally relevant to both of us. Who are these council of elders? Yeah, it could have been the Gerousia, but we don't know. The Gerousia being the Greek word that's sometimes used for Sanhedrin in Philo and Josephus. Parallels to Elijah, who knows? All right. Any other comments that you want to share vocally?
I would like to know, do you think that there is a connection between Josephus's ignorance about the meaning of the word fora and the Babylonian Talmud's question, my Chanukah? They're both Josephus has an implicit question.
Absolutely. I mean, you have.
But is there a connection with the fact that both of them seem to be asking questions?
Only in the sense that when there is debate regarding the significance of a particular event, there tends to be a loss of transmission, right? When there's consensus, the transmission is strong. When there isn't consensus, the transmission is weak. And so when Josephus says in late first century, I'm not sure why we're calling it this, that points to a debated origin story, or at least a debated interpretation. My Chanukah, many centuries later, also points to debate. But I think saying, oh, well, the rabbis invented the miracle and the Second Temple Jews had the military war is going too far. And if we had another hour, I would look at the rabbinic sources and we would look at how, starting with Al-Hanisim, but many other texts as well, highlight the military victory of the Hasmoneans. So let's do away with these binaries. All right. You know where to find me, msimkovich@ctu.edu. It's always a pleasure. Have a wonderful, meaningful Chanukah. Remember that miracles are not made up and we have to respect them, however they happened. All right. Thanks very much. And Chanukah Sameach.